Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and we're going to be taking a trip with imagination, but bear in mind there's going to be a lot of facts in this mind journey. We're going to be talking with a man who has written a book called The Gnostic Mystery. And as I've been telling those of you who have been listening to the programming on a regular basis, I don't often review novels, but this one has so much fact, historical fact in it. It's sort of like the characters have been saran wrapped over all of this, over and around all of this wonderful material. And I know that you would enjoy it as much as I have. My guest today is Randy Davila. Randy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Donna. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Randy, your book, The Gnostic Mystery, is so intriguing because of the fact that you have taken so much material that is factual and cloaked it with this wonderful stage structure of character and action. Now, you graduated with distinction from the Department of Classics, Philosophy, and Religion at the University of Mary Washington in Virginia. And you co-founded and wrote for a very well-known publication called The Free Press. And you have found that fiction is a medium that you really like to deal with. This is your first novel. What is it that created an interest for you where you decided you were going to take this journey with fiction and yet explore all the facts that you have? You've got a bibliography in this book that's just amazing. Tell us how this came to life.
Yes, and Donna, I appreciate you pointing that out, that this is it's fiction, but it's not traditional fiction by any means. In fact, I used the vehicle of fiction in an attempt to tell the truth about the Gnostics, their movement, and the origins of Christianity. And there's two reasons for that. One is that there are some fantastic and fascinating nonfiction books on the subject already, many of which I've listed, as you mentioned, in the back of my bibliography. However, there are not any works of literature that attempt to tell the Gnostic story so succinctly. And so I felt that by doing this, I may be able to reach an audience that might otherwise not pick up an academic or historical text that they may find rather dry. Now, that being said, my next book, I have been encouraged to write a nonfiction book on this very same subject, which I will do. But the other point is that this was, in a sense, it's very Gnostic. The Gnostics were storytellers. They were tellers of parables. Therefore, what more appropriate way to tell the story of the Gnostics using their own vehicle, that of a story?
Why was this an interest for you? I know you've been involved in philosophy and the classics with your studies, but there's always some kind of a trigger, I find, with most people that spurs an interest. What's your personal story relative to this?
Well, my personal story was I grew up in a very, very traditional, loving and traditional home in which I went to a parochial school, a Catholic school, and received all the sacraments and had a very traditional upbringing in that sense. And it was only when I got to college and beyond and began studying that I learned so much about the Gnostics that quite honestly, I was just overwhelmed with this information. And yet here I had spent so many years in traditional church teachings and heard very little, if any, of that information. In fact, the information that I had heard about the Gnostics was quite the opposite. And so it was so revolutionary to me that I felt that the information needed to be shared. And it's amazing to me that today, and maybe we should back up a little bit, because you know the majority of people in America are far more familiar with what an agnostic is than they are with a Gnostic. And, of course, these two, the Gnostics were the ones that came first. The agnostics came later. An agnostic, as you know, is someone who says, I do not know if there is a God or not. Well, that is the opposite of the word Gnostic. It's like known and unknown. A Gnostic is one who says, I do know that there is a God. And when a Gnostic made that statement, it wasn't in a belief sense, or it was in a very mystical sort of, I've had the experience of God through my spiritual journey. And so these were very, very, very mystical group of people that, and as I argue in the book, were central to the formation of the Christian religion. In fact, I think that they were the founders of Christianity, that the founders of Christianity were much more Gnostic like than we would call literalists, that were the other group of Christians that were active at the formation of Christianity, who later became the Catholics.
You have a parable in the front of your book, and I'm going to read it to my audience because I think it says an abundance of things within its content. And this is how it reads. It was written by Anthony DeMello. And it reads as follows. The devotee knelt to be initiated in the discipleship. The guru whispered the sacred mantra into his ear, warning him not to reveal it to anyone. What will happen if I do? Asked the initiate. Said the guru, anyone to whom you reveal the mantra will be liberated from ignorance and suffering, but you, yourself, will be excluded from discipleship and suffer damnation. No sooner has he heard these words than the initiate rushed to the marketplace, collected a large crowd around him, and repeated the sacred mantra for all to hear. The other disciples reported this to the guru and demanded that the man be expelled from the monastery for his disobedience. The guru smiled and said, he has no need of anything I can teach. His action has shown him to be a guru in his own right. I love that story.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, me too. Anthony DeMello, a Jesuit priest from India who was died in 1987, but, you know, was a great mix of Eastern and Western philosophy and thought. And that story in itself is very Gnostic because they claim to have secret information about Jesus. In fact, the most famous Gnostic gospel is the Gospel of Thomas, and it begins by saying these are the secret teachings of Jesus. That he told his most trusted disciples. So the idea was that for the Gnostics was that you could experience God in this life, that you could have a peace and a sense, but it went beyond that. What you needed to do went beyond simply believing as the traditional church teachings mainly held, was that belief was the most important step on the path. The Gnostics would say that was just the first step on the path. The believing in the divinity of Jesus and is important, but that there are several other initiations and rites that one must traverse. And in doing so, the ultimate goal would be to achieve what they called gnosis, which was special knowledge, this special secret knowledge of God, or a special union with God. So in a way, it's kind of akin to the Eastern concept of enlightenment or nirvana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just different semantics. That's what I find so fascinating. Regardless of group, it's something that in any culture, we have the semantics that will be applied. And when those semantics are not understood, good gracious, we've had enough wars caused by religion. It's not a joke. And that's something that you do. You go into, from a historical perspective, and you have two characters in here, two of many, Jack and Punja, that I think are wonderful characters that you have developed, especially the American Jack. Now, who did you base these characters on? Were these people that you sort of identified with in your everyday life, like a professor or someone that you had come in contact with? How did you bring these characters together?
Well, there are each of the main characters represents a different point, I think, on the spiritual path. That was the goal, and they are based on real people. Jack is, in a sense, semi-autobiographical, because, as you know from the book, that he is the one that is amazed upon discovering, and he travels to Jerusalem in an attempt to rekindle the Christian faith of his childhood, and the process comes into possession of some ancient scrolls written by the Gnostics, and with the help of his friends, Unji and Chloe, the professor, he learns far more about a far different version of the history of Christianity. And I think that the history is so important because, you know, we're in a country that is, you know, predominantly considers itself Christian. And yet, if you speak with 90-95% of those folks who recognize themselves as Christian, they know almost nothing about the formation of their religion, and, you know, other than what they've heard from the traditional church teachings, and in the world of academics, our understanding of the formation of Christianity has changed radically in the last 50 years,
mm-hmm.
due to the discovery of the Nag Hammadi Library, which it's called the Nag Hammadi Library now. It was a collection of over 20 Gnostic texts that were found in Nag Hammadi, Egypt, by a shepherd, by mistake. And prior to that, well, we knew scholars knew that these texts existed because we had letters of early Roman Catholic Church members denouncing them, saying, oh, the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, the Gospel of Philip, they're all heretical documents, don't read them, they're horrible, XYZ. And so for the first time after the discovery of Nag Hammadi, scholars could read these letters for themselves. And what they found was that, contrary to the claims of some of the early church fathers, these treatises were in fact very mystical, and there was not near the heretical implications, from one sense, that they had otherwise been accustomed to reading about all these years. So it would be like reading, you know, say 2,000 years from now, reading about the Democratic Party only from Republican, mm-hmm. commercials, or vice versa, reading about the Republican Party only from Democrat. You know, either way, the bottom line is you would not get a clear picture until that group can speak for itself. And that's what happened to a large extent with the discovery of the Nag Hammadi Library. We learned in that and other sources, we've been able to piece together a very diverse picture of the formation of Christianity for the first 300 years, until the Council of Nicaea and Constantine, the Roman emperor, who converted to what at that time was a kind of a proto-Orthodox Christianity or a literalist Christianity, which at that time then became known as the Roman Catholic Church going forward in 325 A.D., But prior to that, there were a variety of Christian movements, which I think for simplification, we can classify those as either Gnostic or literalist, which are / proto-Orthodox Christians.
What's so fascinating about the material you have in your book is that you have incorporated these various aspects of research and discovery, which have evolved, what would you say, since the 70s, where we have had these discoveries? When were these Gnostic gospels found?
Well, there were two important discoveries. We mentioned one, the Nag Hammadi Library in the 1940s. And the other one, I know you're familiar with, is the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Right.
Now, often people, these are often confused or are thought of as the same. They're two different documents discovered, one in Egypt, one in Palestine. But these and documents like that take 20 or 30 years to get out to the public, eye. So you're right. It wasn't until the 70s, even though they were discovered in the 40s, by the time translations became available to the average man and woman, it was much more like the 1970s. And then even after that, it takes a long time for the implications of those documents to sink in. And to, we've had 2,000 years of history that we are now finding, quite frankly, is not correct.
Mm-hmm.
No,
that's very true.
Yeah, and of course, when you look back to in fact, one of the historical figures mentioned in the book was Eusebius, the bishop of Caesarea, who was Constantine's right-hand man and presided over the Council of Nicaea in 326 A.D. and was one of the chief priests involved, bishops involved in the selection of which books made it into the New Testament, the official canon of the New Testament, the one that you have sitting mm-hmm. in your home today. And this man also wrote a document called the Ecclesiastical History of the Christian Church, or the Catholic Church, which painted the Gnostics as heretics and painted the Roman Catholics as the original Christians and had to deal with this Gnostic heresy. And at that time, after that book was published, the Gnostics essentially had fallen out of favor with the Roman, government and with, of course, their adversaries, the Roman Catholics, and they were all killed. Their writings were burned. So within a generation, there was no one to dispute Eusebius' claims of history. Mm-hmm. And that claim of history lasted, believe it or not, for the next 1400 years. It wasn't until the 18th and the 19th century, when scholars really began to look and some other discoveries were made, that people began to question that Eusebius's account was not quite right. Now, I will tell you that today, in academic circles today, Eusebius is not thought of as a credible historian at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in other words, his writings are so loaded. But we have to remember that for 1700 years, it was or for 1400 years, this was this was the gospel truth, so to speak. So things have changed tremendously in the last 50 years as a result of those discoveries.
I know I have had conversations with people because of being able to have access to academic material. I've known of people that have had access to even records in the Vatican that by the time that they got through them, they were just it just totally blew everything out of the water for them. They had not questioned at all anything that they had been given in the way of history. And with what you have done with the information that you have in this book, The Gnostic, and the story that is wrapped so well around the facts, I think that it behooves us to remember that just like with any aspect of history, it's all in many times what a historian wants people to think or to feel.
That's right. History is written by the conquerors. And this is just another case of the conquerors telling one tale. And when we're fortunate enough to discover the writings of the conquered, the whole picture becomes much clearer.
It does, and I even look at the former Soviet Union. That happened not that long ago, in the 90s, where archives were opened up, and I remember reviewing a piece of material that was sent to Harvard on information that a man had found in archives that was all particularly documented. And when, in 1992, there was a series of programs that were put together that the Russian people hadn't even known a lot of what had gone on during the time of Stalin. Now, I'm digressing a little bit here, but it's for a point.
Oh, that's a great example, and you're right. If it can happen in the 20th century when we did have things like TV and newspapers and radio, can you imagine how easy it was to silence a movement and change the history in the 4th century when 98% of the population was illiterate and had no access to any of these, the printing press that wouldn't be invented for 1,000 years. I mean, there was, it was all word of mouth. And if you wanted to silence a movement and you were the government, that was not what's beyond your reach for sure.
Right, because most people never went very far from where they lived. They didn't have transportation. And we have to keep these things in mind. And most people, like you said, were illiterate. Most people did not really know how to defend themselves. They were agriculturally involved. So it didn't take much you know, you burned the crops, people didn't have food, they'd starve to death. I mean, it was a very raw, violent world, and in many ways it's still that way. We just have become a little bit more sophisticated. I like some of the points that you bring out. There is a particular portion in your book where Apunji is talking with Jack about being in the Holy Land, and Jack had observed that in Apunji's home that there were none of the religious icons, if you will, around him, which he had known him to have when they were in college together, but he didn't have them in his home. And in being in the Holy Land, Apunji said, the irony of the situation that we call this place the Holy Land is total madness. It is absolutely has nothing to do in any way, shape, or form with any kind of common sense. And he has seen so much death and disaster, and he said, it's not God that's causing this bloodshed, it's man. And
right,
I found
yep.
those words very potent and very powerful, and it's something that's happened again and again in history, and you bring that point forward in the book quite well.
Thank you. Yeah, Apunji is an ER doctor, so he has the firsthand witness to a lot of the destruction and bloodshed that was going on in the Middle East. It's unfortunately still going on, and that has gone on for, as we know, 2,000 years or better. And, ultimately, I think this is a very Gnostic statement, and that's one of the reasons why they refused to fight. They were not, I wouldn't say pacifist, that's probably a strong language, but the point is that they understood a fundamental truth of that when I say my idea about God is right and yours is wrong, therefore, that ultimately leads, and this room is not big enough for both of us,
mm-hmm.
if we follow, and that's what's happened, so that it's this lack of, and the Gnostics were very, very tolerant, very, very tolerant group, but it's the intolerance of competing ideas, of competing narratives about God and about what it means to worship God that, unfortunately, has caused a lot of human madness over the centuries.
Oh, I'd agree with that. And that's very well documented, and often it's excused. It says, well, we're justified. Gracious, it seems like we're doing the same thing with a different type of a script.
Yeah,
I see different costuming going on at the same time for the same reasons, which is really, really a very sad thing. Now, you take us through this novel, and for those of you listening, it's The Gnostic Mystery. It's very, very good reading with all of the facts of information regarding the falsehoods that have been promoted through centuries. And before we went on the air, I told you about a book that I had read in the 70s called The Word, where someone had tried to convey in their own way a similar kind of a patterning of information. And when that came out, it was really, really, there was so much commotion about it. It was sort of like the Da Vinci Code when it came out. When you see all of these things occurring, Randy, I mean, here you are a historian. You have written this book, The Gnostic Mystery. In fact, the way it ends, it could easily go into a second type of a story. It could be continued. When you did this, did you realize that it was going to end up taking you on the journey that it did?
No, I didn't. It's been a very gratifying and eye-opening journey, and this book has provoked very strong feelings of people on both sides. And I was prepared for some of that, but not prepared for all of what I've seen and heard. And because it does, again, simply coming from a historical standpoint, it does challenge many of the day-to-day ideas that people have about Christianity, such as the virgin birth and the miracles and even the crucifixion and resurrection. The Gnostics saw these events as spiritual allegories. They were teaching stories. They were parables in and of themselves. And that was the exact opposite of the literalists, those who became the Catholic. And they were called the literalists because they believed that everything that happened in uh, that was accounted for in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the Acts of the Apostles, was literal fact, that it actually happened 100% that way. And if you think about it, that's, to a certain extent, not far off from some of the positions that people take in the 21st century today. You know, mm-hmm. there's still a group that is very, very much believe that all of those events happened exactly like that. And then there are another group that, you know, upon further study has seen, gee, things like the virgin birth and the miracle stories, those types of events were very commonplace for gods and godmen in the Greco-Roman world. And therefore, it's much more likely that these were spiritual allegories, that doesn't detract in any way from the beautiful message, the revolutionary message mm-hmm. that Jesus brought. And so when you know, it's been amazing, some of the reactions, you know, on both sides. And my hope, you know, again, this is by no means any sort of atheistic book or a book that's not, you know, no, this is the historical message, I think, points to the fact that that the story of Christianity is far deeper and greater than what we've originally been told. And so this book attempts to decipher and attempts to take some really some complicated material and simplify it and put it in very, very simple terms, you know, the Gnostics and what they believe, and so that the modern reader can take a step back into 2,000 years ago and get an idea of the climate and the ideas that forged the most popular religion in the United States today.
You use a word that I was not familiar with. It's called transvaluation, and it's a literary technique that you say was very popular in the ancient world. And Homer did it. He used the process, and that is
Plato,
something.
Socrates.
Yeah, Plato, Socrates.
Yes, all of them.
Well, let's face it. That's how stories are handed down. I mean, we can find similarities of stories from Greece to Italy, to Turkey, to Africa. There is the power of the story. If you want to have something that is going to stick in the minds of people, and again, staying with the awareness that most of these people were not literate.
That's
when
right.
You go into the old Russian churches, you will see these phenomenal, absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous drawings that they have. They were telling stories. People couldn't
mm-hmm.
read.
Yeah.
And so they were told the stories, and you'd look at that, and that was your way of being able to absorb the story. And the power of the story is so powerful today. It's not any different. Human beings love stories. And when you have the wisdom contained within the stories, that's the value. And like you say, if people say, well, that's an absolute, without having the understanding of historical research, et cetera, which in today's world, my goodness, that's one of the benefits of the Internet, is that we do have the capacity, if we're willing to examine, to be able to look at things. And in today's world, there is more, on some levels, more of an openness of discussion. Because you think it wasn't that long ago, people would have been put to death by questioning things. And in fact, in many parts of the world, you still are.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, the average man and woman has only been literate for just over 100 years, you know, in most cases. So if even that much. And so in that sense, this is the information age. And
mm-hmm.
This is the time in which, you know, fortunately with all the technology and the education, that people are able to, for the first time, to read and make decisions for themselves. And so, you know, in the story, as you said, I wanted to say something about that. You know, story is so powerful. What makes a good story is one that its meaning changes as we grow, that we
mm-hmm.
see it in a deeper, and I think that's incredibly Gnostic. It's very, very, that they're parables, the stories they told. You understood them one way as a child or as a child on the path to Gnosis, but as you matured, the story took on new meaning and different meaning. So a story that can be interpreted on multiple levels at the same time makes a truly meaningful and teaching story.
Well, your novel, The Gnostic Mystery, is wonderful reading. As I told you, my husband absolutely loved it. He was intrigued with it and even was making notes in the margins. I'm notorious for marking up the books I review. Well, he added to that for me. Now, Randy, do you have a website that people can go to?
Yes. Well, the our website, Hampton Roads Publishing, is hrpub.com. That's hrpub.com. And the Gnostic Mystery, and that's, I always like to point out, Gnostic starts with the letter G. That's G-N-O-S-T-I-C. People who haven't seen it written before a lot of times don't know that. And it's available at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, Borders.com, and hopefully at your local bookstore, wherever you're listening to today.
Well, Randy, when you come out with your next one, you'll need to send it to me because the history is fascinating. I so appreciate your being my guest today. For those of you listening, the book, again, is The Gnostic Mystery. That not only do you have facts here, but you have a bibliography at the end of the book. You can take your study even further. But there's a wonderful series of characters that are gently wrapped around this fact and information that I think you will find quite intriguing. Again, Randy Davila, thank you very much for being
my
guest
today. Thank
you,
Donna. Very much. You have a great day.
Thank you, sir. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. Don't go away. We're going to be right back.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's T-TAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717, ttap.com.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a call if you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Here is the toll-free telephone number that you can call into. This goes for anywhere in the world. Telephone lines are open, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. If you're a new listener, I'm so delighted you've been able to join us. And if you'd like to call in and chat with me, all I need from you when I get on the phone line with you is your first name or your initial, and I love to know where you're calling in from. So that's how simple it is. I'll give you what I perceive, and then after that, you're welcome to ask a question about anything that is of importance to you. Again, 888-815-9756 is the toll-free number. I want to remind you this evening, between 6 and 7 Pacific time, I'm going to be a guest on the show Spiritual Hollywood with Katie, the talk show host. And I'm looking forward to this. It's just a delight always to be invited as a guest on people's programming. And as soon as I have the opportunity, I will let you know about a show that was done with a particular host, and I'm not sure when it's going to be aired, but I'll give you that information and you'll be able to hear it when it is. I think it's going to be put online this week. I'm not positive, but I believe that it will, so I'll inform you of that. And anyway, we're just ready to go. If you are, just give me a buzz again at 888-815-9756. That's the telephone number to call in to toll free to let me light up your life with a little bit of insight. I thought I'd share some fun information about plants with you. I know you have heard about carnivorous plants. Mother Nature is so amazing. When you go out like this time of the year, we have had such awesome weather here in the Pacific Northwest that we just, every one of us here are just absolutely ecstatic. The sun has been out throughout the entire holiday weekend. Today it's shining and we just walk around with this glassy-eyed look and a smile on our faces because the sun's out. Yes, we don't grow old here in the Pacific Northwest. We just rust. That's the old adage anyway. So when the sun comes out, we know we have a chance to keep the rust at bay, mentally and in all other ways. But seriously, carnivorous plants, Mother Nature has had all kinds of adaptations. In fact, the more that you study nature, you realize the diversity, how very, very significant it is. Now, carnivorous plants, well, I can't remember the name of the movie that was made about carnivorous plants, but it was really, really popular, and it's just escaping me. I can see the different characters in the movie and how the plant was just eating all kinds of things. It was a big musical. Maybe someone will be able to call in and tell me the name of that show. But anyway, this has really intrigued botanists for a long, long time. And of course, one of the famous botanists that really got into the study of carnivorous plants and other aspects of nature was Charles Darwin. And in the late 19th century, he said he could prove that plants eat animals, primarily bugs. Now, at the time when he came out with this information, and you have to keep this in mind with the way that people think, lots of times when we look at history, we'll say, oh, that was so stupid. Why didn't they know any better? Well, remember just about what we were talking about in the first part of this show. 99% of the population could not read or write. They just didn't have the capacity. They weren't allowed to, often by the ruling class. And that's why in our world today, literacy is so important. But being able to utilize your thinking processes and ask questions and having the freedom to do so is even more important. So when he came out with this, it was called scientific garbage. Ah, yes. We have things like that still going on today. Now, in our world today, botanists obviously know that adaptations to low-nutrient environments have created some 630 carnivorous plant species. And they're in what they call sunlit bogs. And they're around the world. I had no idea there were that many species, 630 of them. Now, these plants have all kinds of qualities and characters. The sundew has sticky leaves that the insects will get caught in. There's a pitcher plant with, it's got enzyme pools, and the Venus flytrap has its clamp. They obtain key nutrients from insects and even small animals. If you don't think nature's interesting, wow, you really need to open up your eyes and really pay attention. There's a lot of stuff going on in this world that most of us are unaware of. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take our first caller today. Caller, welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
Initial H, calling from New York.
Where in New York?
New York, New York.
New York City.
Yeah. All right. And the film and the play took place in New York, and it was Little Shop of Horrors.
Thank you. Yes, it is. Yeah. Such a phenomenal show. I didn't have
wonderful.
Oh, it's hysterical. It really, really
yeah.
is. I love this. Wasn't it a Venus flytrap that was one of the main characters?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow.
The plant, yeah.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad you gave me that information because I knew in my head I could see all of the different scenes. I've never had the privilege of seeing the play, but I do know the movie was just amazing. All the musical scores in this tremendous
mm-hmm.
plant that scarfed up all kinds of things. I mean, it really was something. It was quite a production and extremely, extremely popular. Well, let's get down to business with you, H. I'm looking
okay.
at the fact that there is a lot of paperwork that you're going to be dealing with. And I think you're trying to tidy things up, clean things up. And as I'm watching this going on, I'm really fascinated with the fact that you are putting things in a form of order. And it's as if you are closing a file cabinet, saying, that's that, I can put this stuff away, I don't need to be worried about it anymore. And you're taking what I call little tiny steps, and the organizational patterning that you are putting into place is empowering you in a wonderful, wonderful way. So I have to compliment you. I think you need to pat yourself on the back, because when you look ahead, you want to just sort of cover your eyes and you wish you could put everything in the shredder, it seems like, but you know that that's not the smart thing to do. So just take those little tiny baby steps because it is making a difference. Also, what I am observing is that you're going through a very intense evaluation cycle, very, very intensive evaluation cycle, and this is good. Take your time with it. You're doing the introspection, you're asking questions, you may not have all the answers right now, but the key is you're not trying to avoid getting information. In fact, it's going to be just the opposite. You may find you get so much information that it's actually overwhelming to you. But I watch you. I want you to know you're doing beautifully. Do not get discouraged with this. Just take those little tiny baby steps so that everything moves into positioning in its own way, in its own rhythm, and relax. Because you're going to have like a limbo period for maybe anywhere from 2 to 3 months. So I want you to take advantage of this sort of free flow and trust yourself. You're quite intuitive. So trust your feelings. Do the actual work that needs to be done. All of what you are anxious about is coming into a harmony, coming into a harmonic. And I like this. This is good. So if I were to sum it up, I'd say you have a very healthy, balanced patterning in your life. You are doing what you need to do. Congratulations. Keep up the good work. What question did you have for me?
Well, because right now I find myself not wanting to move and doing very little. And, you know, half of me is like, well, I'm turning into a hermit because I don't feel like going out and doing this or that. But maybe it's in sync with what you're saying.
Just remember, it's little tiny steps, doing a little bit here, doing a little bit there. I'm not seeing heavy pressure on you. And usually that's what you have had a patterning of doing to yourself to get things done. So don't beat yourself up. Go with the flow.
Okay. So, I mean, this feeling of, you know, kind of not moving, not pushing ahead is appropriate at this point.
It's not unhealthy. It really isn't. It's okay sometimes not to really push or do anything. It's all right. Because when you give yourself that space, that allows you to ask questions. I've known of people that have taken what I call sabbaticals, and they'll go to places like maybe a monastery, or they visit a certain part of the country where they won't have a phone, they don't want to do anything, they want to just be left alone. And they'll do a weekend, sometimes people will do a month. Everybody's different. And when individuals will learn about it, they'll say, oh, doesn't it bother you? You don't have a cell phone. You're not doing this. You're not doing that. You're not doing the other. No, that's the reason I'm not doing it. And then what happens is they develop a clarity that really serves them well. So don't be uptight with this. Let it flow. Work with it. And give yourself that position of pleasure and enjoyment. And I think you're going to put the rest of the stuff in order.
Great. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, dear. Have a wonderful day. This
Thanks.
Is Donna Sebo.
Bye.
Hey, phone lines are open for you. 888-815-9756. That's toll-free. And if you'd like to call in and chat, I'd be delighted to do that with you. Give me a buzz whenever you're ready. 888-815-9756. We're going on a break. We'll be right back.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Donna Sebo, give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-815-9756. People can be so wonderfully resourceful, and I came across this story about Darlene McCaslin. She's in Colorado, and she has had a passion for animals all of her life, and she was always bringing home strays of one kind or another. Well, that didn't change when she grew up and became an adult. And for a lot of years, she took in and found homes for animals when people could no longer care for them. And her family, well, it sort of grew, and guess what? She ran out of room. She didn't have the space for animals. But she would keep getting calls because people knew about her, knew of her love for animals and how she had helped so many others. Well, she found that a lot of these people that had pets had reached a point where they couldn't feed them. So she started coming from a different attitude. She couldn't bring any more animals into her home. She didn't have the space. She wouldn't be able to take care of them. So she decided she'd ask a question, and this was the question. If you had help paying for food for your pets, would you be able to keep them? Frequently, she found people could. There were a lot of elderly people who on a limited income just were not able to keep up with the cost of feeding an animal. But they loved him. It was a dearly beloved companion. And so she decided in September of 2007 to found a non-for-profit organization called Pike's Peak Pet Pantry. and she started giving away pet food from her home. Now, what she did in the beginning when she founded this, she used the internet to find clients and donors. Now, there's a website. If you'd like to explore this yourself, if you know of someone that perhaps has needs to feed their pets, go to Pike's Peak Pet Pantry. Try to say that fast five times. PikesPeakPetPantry.org. And they will distribute food out of donated space in a self-storage unit. So far, they have given out, since September of 2007, 17,000 pounds of food, fed more than 2,600 pets, and the organization is still going strong. In fact, they are happy to help people who are going through difficult times to places that will help to pay for vet bills, and you can go to their site again, PikesPeakPetPantry.org, and they'll tell you about other pet food banks that might be in your part of the country, and it has made such a difference for so many pet owners. I think that this is a fabulous, fabulous idea. And if this is something perhaps some of you might be interested in doing for your own local area, if you decide to go to PikesPeakPetPantry.org, you may well have that opportunity to see if you could start up something like this in your own area. Sadly, a lot of people are going through very difficult times. They've lost their jobs. They don't know exactly where they're going to be able to get the means to feed their family. And if they have pets that they love dearly, which are part of their family, something like this is a wonderful, wonderful thing to do, and it can make a difference and enable a family to stay together entirely. There are a lot of shelters I know that here in the Pacific Northwest have been finding animals dropped off, foreclosed homes. They have found animals in these homes just left. So when they take them out, they're trying to bring them back to health. But if people know that there is an option where they can take care of these animals, feed them, it really can make a difference. So anyway, I thought that was information that you might be interested in. Otherwise, you can give me a call at 888-815-9756. That's worldwide, toll free. Now, I want to let you know who's going to be coming on with me tomorrow. Hope Warshaw is going to be my guest. We're going to be talking about diabetes. And I know one day there is going to be that cure. We're going to understand how chemically we can keep the body in good balance. We all know how important good nutrition is. And diabetes is often very much regulated by dietary and physical patternings that we have. So we're going to be talking with Hope about how, if you have been diagnosed with this condition, you do not need to be paralyzed by it. You can have a very normal, a very healthy life. It may need a change in your lifestyle patternings, but it doesn't have to be a tremendously difficult one. So we're going to be talking about that tomorrow. And then Camille Bishop is going to be my guest on Thursday. We're in this boat together. If you have a business and you would like to know some tips, some suggestions about how you can work more effectively with the varying generations of people in the marketplace, in the workplace, then this is something you're not going to want to miss. Powerfully written book. I really liked what Camille did with it. And then Dr. David Dolman's going to be with me on Friday. I love the title of his publication, Why Don't Doctors Know This? And I think you're going to find that this is going to be very enlightening. It's dealing with nutrition. That's all I'm going to tell you. But wow, it is power-packed, and we're going to be sharing some of that information with you. So we've got a great lineup of guests. And, of course, in the month of June, which is just around the corner, I have got a dynamic lineup of people. I feel we're so fortunate in this world today, one, to be able to communicate so well, so effectively via the Internet, and two, to have all these wonderfully talented people that want to bring their level of perspective, knowledge, and information to you if you're open to receiving it. We're out of time. This is Donna Seabold. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Have a phenomenal day. Enjoy the sunshine. and be grateful that you as an individual are able to express yourself with freedom and in your life make your own choices. Donna Sebo here. We'll talk with you tomorrow, same time, same place. Don't forget, here on BBS Station 1, tonight we're going to be talking with Katie on Spiritual Hollywood. Hope to talk to you then. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.